You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. We at New Dimensions thank you for your support. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Our guest today suggests that all living things die and go on to become other things. This cycle is simple, observable, undeniable. The certainty that our life ends distinctively and decisively is a hard truth to come to terms with. The truth is that no one fails at death. Total embrace is death's core dignity. So the advice is just this: participate. Resist the notion that you have total control. Resist the notion that you have none. However you can, with whatever you've got, participate in your care, in your dying, and your life. And there is resource to help us in the form of a most extraordinary book by Dr. B.J. Miller and Shoshona Berger. This precious volume is like having a loving friend by our side with practical advice on the medical, legal, logistical, and emotional aspects of an event that awaits us all. And that is what we'll be exploring today with my guest, Dr. B.J. Miller. B.J. Miller is a hospice and palliative medicine physician who has worked in many settings, inpatient, outpatient, hospice facility, and home, and now sees patients and families at UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Miller speaks all over the country and beyond on the theme of living well in the face of death. He's also the founder of the Center for Dying and Living, and he's the co-author with Shoshona Berger of A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. Join us for the next hour as we explore and deepen our understanding and navigation of the complexities of this universal human experience of dying with our guest, Dr. B.J. Miller. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. B.J., welcome.
Thank you, Justine. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I've just been immersed in this book, and you just answered so many questions and brought up so many issues that concern us all. And I know that you make a statement, the purpose of this book isn't so much to help you die as it is to free up as much life as possible until you do. So elaborate on that. What is that? Why?
Well, there are a couple ways into that comment, Justine. One is watching how much energy many of us put into keeping death at bay, not looking at it, running away from it. There's an extraordinary amount of energy that it takes to keep reality at arm's length. I mean, so one is just letting that go and coming to terms with the idea that life includes death. It's not opposed to death. It includes death. And older societies, older cultures all know this. This is one of the tells that the U.S. is a young place. So that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at that statement is, thanks to modern medicine, which in many ways I'm a fan of. It's my industry. It saved my life. There's much to say about it. But there's a lot to critique in healthcare. And we're in this funny moment where our technology has advanced to the point where, you know, you can prop a body up practically indefinitely. I mean, so it raises questions about what is life, what is death. And so we have a healthcare system where at some point, You probably have to actually say no, thank you. You almost have to opt out if you want to have something approaching a peaceful death. So I think that's a really important piece of this puzzle. I think not too long ago, we could all just sort of trust our physician to do what's possible. And when the list of things to try ran out, then we'd say, okay, I'm going to move from fighting mode to accepting mode and off I'll go. That doesn't really work anymore. You could be consumed in the medical hamster wheel. And before you know it, the end is right in front of your face. So that's one big reason for this book, is to help people navigate the health system and the minefield that it is. But in the service of freeing up a lot of life for yourself in the meantime. So anyway, there we could talk for a long time about the answer to that particular point. I will say one more thing about it, though, Justine, which is, it's something that you probably know from your work already in the circle work. And I know a lot of folks who do hospice work or people of faith. Anyone who's managed to keep death in their view, you know, on the one hand, you'll hear people say, oh, that must be so morbid or that must be so depressing. Well, sure, it's sad. But for the most part, it's also really life-affirming. When you come to terms with that your life is finite, this body's life is finite, well, then you start taking time seriously, and you stop squandering your time, and you start appreciating what you have while you have it. So this is the secret that a lot of hospice providers know. That's why a lot of hospice providers are actually very happy people and sort of filled with life. It's because they know that death is real and that their time is limited.
Well, you're talking about the medical field and all the benefits of it. You have been the benefit of that. I'd love for you to share a little bit of your background and your story about how you actually got into medicine in the first place. And so going back to your sophomore year in college.
Yeah, you got it. I had not been interested in medicine before I became disabled myself, before I had an injury. So sophomore year of college, right around this time of year, I was screwing around with some friends and hopped up on top of a parked commuter train. And I had a metal watch on, and I got close enough to the power source that the electricity arced to the watch. And that was it. I mean, it was a big, you know, sort of instantaneous moment. I was in the hospital in the burn unit there for many months. Lost both legs below the knee and my left arm below the elbow, you know, and came close. You know, part of me died, you could say, and I came very close to death. I became aware. Of course, we all know we die, blah, 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 but it sounds like it's this abstract thing that's endlessly deferrable. But at age 19, I came to realize that it was very real, and we could go there anytime in an instant. So that was a moment that sort of acquainted me with death. Obviously, that's a very potent moment. But really, it was my recovery period, kind of grieving and coming to terms with what I had lost and coming to terms with what I still had and realizing that I was learning so much from this experience. It put me in touch with the side of humanity and human nature in myself and among my friends, and taught me how to rely on others and find a way to actually celebrate our dependence on each other. This idea that we're independent, I don't need anything, especially when you're 19. Well, that's just so obviously just, well, I say obviously, It's obviously untrue. We need each other all the time. I don't think there's an independent person that's ever lived, ever walked this planet. So I got in touch with the sort of shortcomings of our language, the sort of importantly inaccurate sort of statements we live under, the framing of disability, you know, all this stuff. I kind of really got to dig into myself. I got to refashion myself, all with around this design prompt of loss, right squarely in the center, and grief squarely in the center, which brought beauty into the mix, which brought love into the mix, which brought interdependence into the mix, all this sort of beautiful mix. So that was really what turned me on to the potential of healthcare, of being in medicine and working with people who were going through things that they'd rather not go through, but had to.
I thought it was interesting that when you, there were two things that you did before you got into medicine in college.
Yep.
You first took some art history courses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I'd like for you to say, what did you learn from that?
That was
an interesting choice.
It was. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, I was so lucky. I got amazing care. I had a family who rallied around me. I had friends. I mean, I had, you know, everything that could go well within that crazy context. I had incredibly good fortune. But I will take some credit for a few choices. And one of those choices was to, when I went back to college the following fall, I changed my concentration to art history. I had never made art. I had enjoyed art. But I hadn't really thought seriously about it until I was lying in the hospital bed for many months and thinking on the question of identity, like, who am I now? Am I less of a person now that I have fewer body parts? Do I need to apologize for my existence? Was I going to have a girlfriend again? I don't know. Well, who was I? You know, was basic down to the studs, kind of revisiting who I was, myself. And so that's where I found my mind going. And so the questions of who am I? What is myself? I mean, I suppose you could exercise those questions in a religious context. But my mind went really more squarely to the art world, to the creative world, because, well, I guess the hunch was that artists make things that otherwise don't exist. They take material, it takes stuff, things that they can't change, and make something new from it. You know, they project their experiences into the material world. They play with the material world, and that seemed like such a healthy attitude in a way for me. Like, here I was revisiting all my materialness. And I had the sense that I had this raw material to work with. I had an excuse to refashion myself. And it seems like I had much more to learn from the artists than I did from anybody else. That was the hunch. And so that's why I went into study art history. And it was a really good move. Because what I really ended up learning, of course, was perspective. You know, it's not what you see, but how you see it. And we human beings have this incredible talent, this incredible capacity, unlike some of our other friends like Maisie here, for your listeners, my dog is here with us. Who knows what goes on in her mind, but it does feel, this does feel like we humans have this particular talent of, we can change our lenses. We can change how we look at things. And that's the way to change the world. That's a much more reliable way than going out and trying to change the external world. You can change how you see it. And that's what I learned from studying art. And you can imagine the therapeutic value of that.
Absolutely. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. B.J. Miller. He is the co-author with Shoshona Berger of A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to the website. It's called thecenterfordyingandliving.org. Or you can give there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Thank you. I'm here with Dr. B.J. Miller, and he's a co-author with Shoshana Berger of A Beginner's Guide to the End. That doesn't sound, that, if we just stop there, it just sounds like, uh-oh. But, you know, one of the statistics that you had that was mentioned in the book was 10 to 20% of us will die without warning. Only that little bit. When I read that, I thought, you know, we all wish for maybe a swift death and no suffering and and just kind of go out quickly with very little pain, I guess. Well, at least that's my hope. Sometimes I'll hear how someone's died and maybe they died in their bed of a stroke or something like that. And they were gone really quickly. And I always say, oh, that's a good death. But what you're saying here is that's not the way most of us are going to go. So we have, as you've just spoken about this perspective we have a choice as to how we orient ourselves towards this inevitability. And let's just talk about some of the things that we can do that are very, very practical. And one of the biggies is called the medical directive. Let's talk about that medical directive. What is it, and and why do we need it?
Okay, so well, advanced care planning is sort of the process that we all about thinking about your death, thinking about your legacy, et cetera. So, advanced care planning, if you hear that phrase, is sort of writ large, this sort of process of preparing for your death. An advanced directive or a medical directive, that's a subset. That is a legal document. That is very much meant to, it asks several questions what you might want for, whether you'd want life-sustaining treatments or artificial nutrition, hydration, these kinds of things. But probably the most important question you'll answer on an advanced directive is, who is your durable power of attorney for healthcare? Who is your medical proxy, is another way we phrase this. And your proxy is that person who would speak on your behalf if you no longer can. Because as we know, things happen, and you can find yourself in a coma, you can find yourself uncommunicative in all sorts of ways, and then you can't speak. Right. Then you can't relay your wishes anymore.
And then you might be in that situation that you spoke of earlier, in that on some sort of contraptions that are sustaining your life.
Yes, you will.
And if you're in the hospital, that's what happens, isn't it?
Yes, that is what happens. That is the default setting. So what everyone's got to understand is, if you don't fill out your advance directive, if you don't make your wishes known in some real way, then you're going to go down the default pathways in our medical system. And if, on some level, of course, it makes sense that we'd want the default to be, let's do everything we can to sustain their life, their bodily life. That, I understand that reasoning, but the problem is we've gotten sort of too good at that, and you can exist on machines indefinitely. And that may be very much not what you want. So you have to sort of, you have to realize, if you do nothing, if you say nothing, the pathway you will be on is the ICU, machines, et cetera, et cetera. That is the default. Those serve a purpose sometimes. I've been on those machines myself. But at the end of a long illness, if those machines, you're generally not coming off of them. And then you put your family in a position to say whether or not they're going to, quote unquote, pull the plug. And that's an agonizing decision. So back to your question about an advance directive, one of the reasons to do this paperwork is so that you have a good chance of getting your wishes met, for one, but maybe even more powerful is it's such a loving thing to do to your, for your family and friends, the people who are going to be gathered around your bedside, because they'll know what you want. They're not going to be put in a position to guess what you want and feel like they're choosing whether you live or die by pulling the plug.
And if, let's suppose, if we are part of an HMO, mm-hmm. You can file that mm-hmm. with, or if you have a regular physician, you can file that with your physician yes. or your HMO. So it's not only your family that has it, but yes. the whole healthcare system can now log it into yes. this database.
Yeah, a really important point. So practically speaking, so yes, do your paperwork. But also, by the way, Justine, it's important to revisit it over time because we change our mind as we go along, right? What you want right now may be very different from what you want a year or two from now, right?
Exactly.
So you need, this is not a one-time thing. Revisit this conversation over time.
I think you mentioned in the book that we do our taxes every mm-hmm, year. Mm-hmm. So maybe along with doing yeah. our taxes, we pull out that medical directive and we read it again yeah. and say, does this still apply?
Right. That would be a great habit to get into. Or when, you know, at the time of a big diagnosis or any big life events is a good time to revisit these things. Not just the paperwork, but the conversations with your family and friends so that they know who you are, what you want, et cetera. So it's beyond the paperwork. The paperwork's important. I want to circle back to what you said, Justine, is technically, an advance directive is a legal document. It's not a medical document. And there's much talk about the distinction there. But let me just say to finish the thought that you brought up. Yes, do this paperwork. Make sure someone can find it. It's in a place that's findable. Make sure to share it with your healthcare proxy and your family. And make sure to share it with your doctor. In fact, review it with your doctor because some of your thinking that's affecting your answers may be sort of medically impossible or maybe off, you know. So yes, state your wishes, but really it's about having a conversation with people you love and with your healthcare team and do that frequently. Your doctor should be asking you about this. Hospitals, by law, are supposed to offer you an advance directive and inquire whether you have one. But very often, it's sort of a checkbox pro forma moment that is not a lot of yeah. time is spent with it.
Exactly.
So you take this control. This is one way we can take control ourselves.
And that's another whole part of it is that you really encourage, like I used in the introduction, participate, to mm-hmm. be active.
Yeah.
You can't expect your doctor or your HMO or whatever yeah. to yeah. come knocking on your door. You've got to be proactive with this.
That's right. It's a huge point. Like I think a lot of us fantasize. Someone asked me about, so where is Marcus Welby now? You know, like, you know, this beloved doctor
yes.
who knows us so well and looks after us.
Right.
There are still family physicians. And there are small communities where people, everyone knows their doctor and their doctor knows everyone. And all that, that's still, that exists, but it's not the norm anymore by miles. And even if you're lucky enough to have a very loving, thoughtful physician on your side, that doctor is pulled in so many directions. So even if you have yourself a Marcus Welby, the system as it currently stands and the need, the volume of need is such that you can't just assume that that doctor is going to do exactly what you'd hope for and want. There's just no time for that anymore.
And you point out in the book that there's a silver, you call it silver,
the silver tsunami. Yeah.
Going on, like of people are older and
yes.
and they, it's like yes. happening in healthcare. It's like overwhelming the whole system, I'm sure.
It is. Well, we have a couple of things going. So we have an aging population. This is sort of the other side of the success of public health is that we're living longer. Okay, that's a good thing. But we're living longer with a lot of illness. We're living with diseases and illnesses and disabilities that would have otherwise killed us a few years ago. Now we're able to live with. We're helping people live longer. We're helping people live with things that used to kill them. But that means they're not necessarily able to work. That means they're drawing Social Security for longer periods of time, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you can imagine there are huge financial repercussions. But from a healthcare system point of view, that means we have a sheer tonnage of more and more people mm-hmm. who need more and more help who are also not fixable by definition. They are chronically ill. They're suffering with diseases that they can't be fixed, but they're still living with. So you've got this bulge in the population of people with huge needs, and so our already overwhelmed social and healthcare systems are about to get even more so.
And that fixed sort of thing, that's you talk about that in the book. You really make a distinction between that which cannot be changed and that we have to work with, and then that which can be.
Yep.
And there's that's where the idea of suffering, how can we choose to open up to that kind of suffering if we're in a chronic condition?
Yes.
And chronic pain.
Yes. This is such an important distinction in terms of the experience of living with illness or disability. That experience is doled out over time. I mean, to your point about suffering or pain, you know, acute suffering, acute pain, well, by its nature, first of all, there's some utility to it. If I touch a hot stove, I need that pain to tell me to move my finger before it burns, right? There's a purpose to the signal of pain. Chronic pain's a real bear. Chronic nausea, chronic anything is a very different animal because it's like your body, I got the signal, fine, I'm in pain, my body's telling me to do something different, to change something. But when the symptoms become chronic, there's nothing to change, there's nothing to do, there's no hot stove to move your finger from. And so for the effect, the impact, your listeners, anyone who's had chronic pain or chronic symptoms of any kind knows it's a different animal and it wears on you in ways over time that are really, really can be brutal. Deflating, demoralizing, can change your identity, your mood, your relationships, on and on and on. So what to do about that? Well, acute pain, it's sort of like you can grit your teeth and get through it. Chronic stuff, you've got to say, okay, you're in my life now, Mr. Chronic Pain. I need to have a relationship with you. I can't kick you out of my body like I've been trying to do. So pull up a chair and let's work this out. Let's figure out how we can live with each other. You know, I mean, it really pays, in my experience, to sort of craft a relationship with the things that you can't change. By doing so, you have a much better chance of not suffering quite so much. You have a way of sort of diminishing the signals that pain sends.
Because of the mere acceptance of it?
The acceptance.
So you're not resisting?
That's right.
Is that what you're saying?
That's like, a big part of it. That's right. I mean, resisting suffering is itself so much the source of the suffering. This is where spiritual traditions, Buddhism, other things, anything that helps us accept the reality we have, to not go to war with the reality we have, anything that allows us to actually be with ourselves, be with our lives as they are, that's a very potent technology, if you will. That's a very useful thing.
So in your own life, with your own disabilities, that without part of an arm and part of two of your legs, your life doesn't look as if it's diminished. It's changed.
Yes, right. Right. Well, you bring up that's such a good rhetorical point. It's changed. Our propensity to judge and put value, it's better or worse, good, bad, black or white, all this sort of, we love to verticalize things. In fact, the only thing we can say, just as you did, is my life is not better or worse than it would have been with four limbs. It's just different. The accident changed my experience. It took me a while to get there, to actually feel that. And would not be lying to say that. So it took a while. But when I got there, the suffering per se stopped. I can still have pain, but I'm not at war with my pain. I'm not hating myself or hating my body for being in pain. It's part of the deal. I've roped it in to my experience. This is my life. This is not a threat to my life. This is my life. And so whatever can help us get there and see things as a change, a horizontal move, not a vertical one, I find that extremely both useful, but also kind of fascinating. That's where also things can get very creative.
I'm here with Dr. B.J. Miller, and he's co-author with Shoshana Berger of A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
Thank you.
I'm here with Dr. B.J. Miller, and he is co-author with Shoshana Berger of A Beginner's Guide to the End. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to the website, thecenterfordyingandliving.org. B.J., I know that you work with palliative care. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between that and hospice?
Great question. There's so much misunderstanding.